Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me as always is my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, say hi.
Hi, glad to be here.
What have you been up to?
Well, I got a bit of good news and bad news for you.
Okay.
So the good news is I finally managed to get a photo of the red kite.
Whee!
The bad news is that photo is about as good as the big cat photos from Britain. It's really blurry and blotchy. I could see that it was a red kite, but my camera couldn't. So I'm going to keep trying though. So I'm closer. I need to take the actual proper camera out. But again, doesn't really have the right lens to do it on. But yeah, other than that, I mean, fighting the last bits of illness and getting ready for this live show in April.
Well, we are now up on the library's website as well and everything.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, you and me both, when it comes to fighting off illness.
Yes, I was going to say.
As you can hear, there's probably still a bit of a wheeze in me voice. I'm trying not to cough and splutter all over the microphone. I've had one interesting encounter with wildlife this week. I went to go and do the recycling in the morning, put the bins out. And as I was sort of sorting everything, putting stuff into the different boxes and putting it out for the recycling men to basically then throw all across the road, as they usually do. In that box, there was a little vole who'd managed to get in there and get caught.
Lovely.
So I thought, well, I'm not letting you loose out the front here because there's far too many cats that roam around this area. Yeah. I'll let him loose into the back garden where the grass is still nice and long and there's lots of places for him to hide. So go to the front door and call Paris to come and open it and go, okay, I'm going to bring a vole through now. Hopefully it doesn't jump out of the box and into the house somewhere. So you just sort of very quickly and carefully sort of bring this box with a vole through, show the child, lovely little vole who wants to obviously try and grab it. No, he's probably going to bite you if you do that. And then back out and straight into the grass. And yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, that was a nice way to start the day.
I tell you what I have done, Gareth, actually, that I think you would have liked. I went for a picnic in Witherpool, which is a little village in Exmoor, right? And me and my daughter went wading into the river there because it's quite shallow. Mm. And there were loads and loads and loads of these tiny little fry, tiny little baby fish.
Probably trout or salmon or something up that way.
Yeah, they're probably no longer than my thumb. But which is probably not a good way to measure it on a podcast that's audio format.
No. I mean, but standard human thumb size.
Yeah. But they're a beautiful kind of browny, silvery color, and there's loads of them there. There's also ducks and also whilst we're having our picnic, I managed to spot a lone red deer walking across a field nearby. So I have actually had more wildlife this week than I thought about. Sometimes I do things that
about them.
Yeah.
How many thumbs exactly is a duck or a red deer, by the way?
I reckon from that distance, the red deer was probably a thumb there.
A thumb from the distance, yeah. That's fair enough. Well, shall we? We'll let you figure out how many thumbs exactly as we head on into the news, shall we?
Let's do it.
It's the news!
Right, well, we're into this week's news. And Aaron, what do we got?
Every week, we're inundated with news coming out of the weird and wonderful world of natural sciences. And though we are but a small team, we want you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, to be kept up to date on the good, the bad, and the extraordinary. So let's open up our natural history cupboard newsreel, where we've compiled some of the more interesting headlines, and dive in.
And I believe that would be me first. And I have gone to New Scientist first off. Asian elephants seen burying their dead for the first time. Five elephant calves have been found buried in a drainage ditch on a tea-growing estate in India in a rare example of burial behavior in non-human animals. There is a photo that comes along with it of an elephant pulling along the dead calf in a tea estate in northern Bengal. The elephants were documented deliberately burying the bodies of their calves in the first scientific report of such behavior in the species. Five buried calves were discovered in drainage ditches, all of their feet and legs protruding from the ground. Basically, they kicked a bunch of soil over them to bury the bodies. So
that is absolutely fascinating. It seems like, and this is why when I explain like elephants in captivity, like you can have the most high tech enclosure for them, but like a laptop, once it's there, once it's all built and done, the next day it's out of date because you learn something so world-shakingly new and different about them. The last elephant article we did, I think, was my elephant article on them actually having names for each other, which is a sign of having an actual proper language. So that, I mean, this is just another really cool, if a little bit, you know, like sad to hear, item of news about an animal that just gets more fascinating every day.
Well, yeah, I mean, more proof that yet again, we're nothing special.
Yeah. My first article comes to us from Isle of Wight County Press, and it's one that me and Gareth both did, but I managed to beat him out on it. And the headline is, Grey Seal Spits Water at Sea Eagle on Isle of Wight. So not so much a news article as a pretty cool and once-in-a-lifetime shot for one photographer who managed
to... photo.
It's a really good photo, yeah. She managed to document the event in Newtown Creek as a white-tailed eagle made its approach to the water surface, presumably on the hunt, when an adult grey seal erupted right under the bird. The camera captured the seal warning the eagle with a series of vocal protests before resorting to ejecting a stream of water right at the approaching bird of prey.
That's really quite cool.
Very cool.
You need to see the photo to basically believe it. It does look very staged. If it weren't for the fact that these are not two animals that are generally, you know, used to stage things. So my next article comes from the BBC, and it's Sycamore Gap. New life springs from rescued tree. Remember, I think it was you, Aaron, that brought us the rather sad news of the Sycamore Gap tree, a very large sycamore that was growing out of Hadrian's Wall in Northumberland. But new life has sprung from the rescued seeds and twigs of this particular tree that was mysteriously cut down, giving hope to the iconic tree in the future. The BBC has seen the new shoots of the on a rare visit to the Secret National Trust Center protecting the seedlings. So they've obviously taken some cuttings from what was left of it to try and get it to replant, I guess. The actual tree is just a stump left now. If it's healthy, a new tree could eventually grow from it there. But the young twigs and seeds thrown to the ground when the tree was toppled were salvaged by the National Trust, who care for the site and have been looking after them since. And the exact location of the actual nursery is kept a secret. Other than the fact that it's a high security greenhouse somewhere in Devon. So
in Devon?
Quite many whales. We've been measuring things in thumbs. Now we're in whales, away from Devon, from Northumberland. So yeah, it's being protected in a greenhouse in Devon.
By high security greenhouse, I hope that's literal, and they've used like gorilla glass or something.
I mean, there's a photo of it
like, as the glass.
There's a photo of this secret greenhouse, which. I don't think it's probably very secret. If you know the right people to talk to.
Google and then you'll be able to find it. But unless there's armed security, like gardeners with shotguns waiting outside.
What I do find a little disturbing is they probably feel the need to have done this for the simple reason that whoever the absolute sicko that cut this tree down, there's probably people who would quite happily revel in destroying any new growth or anything to just
and
that's the worst of humanity in that sort of setting. So evidently, and
some of them will do it.
Keep it hidden.
Some people will do that, not because they want to. They probably didn't even. They're probably not. They wouldn't have ever cut the original tree down. It's just that they saw how many people were affected by the tree being cut down that they want to spread that pain.
Well, you're the Batman enthusiast. What's the quote?
Some people just want to watch the world burn, Mr. Wayne.
There you go.
So my next article comes to us from Science Alert. It actually comes to us via Louise O'Leary, one of our long-time listeners who sends us a lot of articles in, and definitely does a shout-out and is very patient because she keeps sending them in and I keep forgetting to put them in. They are being put in, Louise, so thank you for continuing and thank you for your patience. This headline is, "This insanely tiny frog could be as small as vertebrates get." So the frog that's the size of a pea, the flea toad, is so small it may in fact approach the lower limit for vertebrate animal size ranges. Found in Brazil's Serra Bonita mountain range, they were initially identified as toads, hence the name, before further study re-clarified that they were indeed frogs. The previous holder of the minuscule title was also a frog species, but that one was heralded in from Papua New Guinea.
My final article is from Nature, and it's entitled, "Got Milk? Well, meet the weird amphibian that nurses its young." So, if you've ever heard of a Sicilian, you'll know what I'm talking about. But if you haven't, a Sicilian is essentially the amphibian answer to being a snake in many ways. Although, if anything, they look more like a big worm. You can kind of see they are absolutely fantastic little creatures. So Sicilians are known to feed their offspring on their skin. But a new study has shown that, in fact, they may be also producing milk. Now, this isn't milk in the same sense of a mammal. This is, well, quite different. And lactation is considered a key characteristic of mammals. A handful of other animals, including birds, fish, insects, and even spiders can produce nutrient-rich liquid for their offspring. So similar to milk in some ways. There are over 200 Sicilian species, and they're found throughout the tropics, most of which live underground and are pretty much functionally blind. Around 20 species are known to feed their unborn offspring, hatching inside of their reproductive system, which is quite different for most amphibians, a type of milk. But this new science study, for the first time, has described an egg-laying amphibian doing this for offspring hatching outside of the body. The liquid is functionally similar to mammalian milk, the study's co-author Carlos Jared has said. So yeah, it's an odd way to be able to survive, but they eat the nutrient-rich layers of the mother's skin and the secretion as well. Feeling hungry?
Well, not anymore. My last article comes to us from a bit of an odd place, actually. Jen Babb sent this one in to us, and it comes to us from Blabbermouth Online, which is, from what I could gather, it was like a rock music kind of website. The headline is, "190-million-year-old fossil named in honor of Alice Cooper." Serpula Alice Cooperi is a species of serpulid worm, which is a marine life form that lived in calcified burrows 190 million years ago. They would filter seawater with their tentacles during this Jurassic period, and their ancestors are doing very much the same thing in today's marine environment. But researchers felt that of all musicians, Alice Cooper deserved to be honored the most, a sentiment with which I cannot agree with at all. But that may just be...
Really?
I cannot stand Alice Cooper. I think
you can't stand Alice Cooper. You know, he's a massive fan of snakes.
Well, in that case, I mean, I'm not saying I can't stand Alice Cooper the person. I'm just saying I don't like his music.
What's wrong with Alice Cooper?
It's like, what's the way of describing it? Like, it's like someone wanting to ride off of rock, but not really being rock. You know, like when I think of like the kind of music, like rock music, I just don't think of Alice Cooper.
No,
I have no problem with him as a person. I'm sure he's a great person, and the fact that he likes snakes is a big But a big positive in my books, but it's just I just don't like his music. But art is subjective, it's in the eye of the beholder. I like music that I'm sure other people won't like, and that Alice Cooper himself would say is not really music. So, and that's fine, that's fine. If we can't disagree on things in a nice way, then the world becomes pretty boring.
True.
That about wraps it up for this week's Natural History Cupboard newsreel. If you guys at home have any articles or topics of interest that you'd like to see us, or hear us rather, cover, you can send them in using any of the methods that you know how to get hold of us, email or through social media or through smoke signals or through didgeridoo across wide expanses. But yeah, get them sent in to us and we'll get through them. I promise we are starting to crack through them now. But with that said, we'll move on to the main topic of news now, and that is being brought to us today by Gareth.
So, Aaron, you and I have, and our listeners are probably aware, been fossil hunting multiple times on the Somerset coast. In fact, our ill-fated trip for our New Year's episode, which did not go so well, was in the very region that this particular story finds itself in, if not just a little bit further on. So you may remember, as we were in Watchet and Blue Anchor, you can see in the distance the Butlin's holiday camp at Minehead. You can't miss it. The thing's huge. For anyone who's not been there, imagine a giant circus tent essentially right on the beachfront, and it's quite easy to spot from a distance. Well, if we'd have continued on a little bit further, we could have been the ones who made this groundbreaking discovery, Aaron. It's always the way. It's always the way.
Yeah.
So this comes from The Guardian, and it's world's oldest fossilized tree discovered along Devon and Somerset coast. And these are fossilized sections of what's called a camelomorphaton. They are essentially early forerunners to trees. And they helped shape the landscape at the very early parts of the Devonian era. They are somewhere around 390 million years old, and they've been found in cliffs along the Devon and Somerset coast. So just where Minehead is just on... It's not far from the border of Devon, is it? I'm trying to picture...
No, not at all.
...on that particular area. And to be honest, I didn't know that there were any fossil-producing bits of Devonian-era rock around that part of Minehead. So these fossilized trees are the oldest ever found. They're roughly 4 million years older than the previous record holder, which was in New York State. So these fossilized trees, known as camelotyphon, would resemble palm trees from a distance if you didn't know what you were looking at. The moment you look at them, though, and, you know, realize it's not a palm tree because palm trees haven't even evolved at this particular point, you would know that they are not. They're very much the forerunners of trees that we are familiar with today. Rather than solid wood, the trunks were thin and hollow in the center, and they stood between 2 and 4 meters tall. They also didn't have leaves. Their branches were covered in hundreds of twig-like structures. So imagine, if you will, almost like get two halves of a celery stick and glue them together.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, there's no actual use for celery. It's bloody awful none. Stuff. So glue them together so it's hollow in the center. Or, in fact, if you wanted to go for something that's actually more like that, there's lots of plants today that have got hollow stems that are often just full of, like, air pockets, making it obviously quite light. But these tall structures then would have had lots of little twig-like branches on the top. So imagine it having just a little bushy bit on the top, to give you an idea, and only 4 or so meters tall. So the fossils were found near Minehead on the south bank of the Bristol Channel, near the Butlin's holiday camp, which is in some ways kind of infuriating. This was a pretty weird forest, not like that of any forest that you would see today, says Professor Neil Davies, a geologist of the University of Cambridge, and the study's first author. There wasn't any undergrowth to speak of as well. Grass obviously hadn't appeared, but there were lots of twigs dropping off these densely packed trees, which had a big effect on the landscape. Scientists have previously assumed that this stretch of the English coast did not contain significant plant fossils, but this find shows that early trees helped shape the landscape and stabilize riverbanks, coastlines for hundreds of millions of years. And the results are, well, basically now being reported in the Journal of Geological Sciences. The forest is from the Devonian era, which is about 358 to 419 million years ago. And this is essentially known as the era of fish. The Devonian era is named after Devon. Most life at this point is still in the sea. You've got the start of these forests appearing on land. And the biggest thing you're probably going to see wandering around on land at this point are invertebrates that are tied to water as well. Fish just maybe starting to, you know, get towards the banks. Tiktaalik just coming out of rivers and that in parts of what would be Canada, I believe that's where, no, Alaska, I think Tiktaalik's from. And things like Dunkleosteus living in the oceans, which gives you an idea that there isn't much, you know, big stuff on land. So these plants were helping to shape the ecosystem that would then give the next group of animals the major boost to life on land, which would be for the giant forests that covered the Earth during the Carboniferous period and allowed invertebrates to get absolutely massive. We see, you know, things like the giant temnospondyl amphibians as well, the start of the reptiles, and also all the carbon that we essentially use in our fossil fuels today. So yet another amazing find in the world of paleontology in Devon. So yeah, we'll have to go and check that one out and do a hell of a lot better job at filming it if we can find it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Maybe if we time it right, we can spend more time down there.
Well, you never know. Yeah. So yeah, there is our fantastic news of more fossil finds in Devon. Should we add into our creature feature for this week?
Yeah, I think we're going from the kind of North Devon, North Somerset coast to a very Antipodean riparian environment.
Ah.
It's the creature feature.
Right, well, we're into this week's creature feature. Aaron, what are we looking at?
This week, Gareth, we're going unique. Really unique, not only belonging to the weird order of monotremes, but also being the only extant monotreme that isn't an echidna. A quick word on monotremes, just really brief. The monotremes are indeed mammals and nurse their young on milk, just like other mammals. However, monotremes retain the egg-laying stage of the reproductive cycle, much like the mammal order's prehistoric ancestors, the synapsids. So they both lay eggs and they like reptiles, and they nurse their young on milk like mammals. So really weird and interesting. These guys are made even more unique by the addition of a venomous spike and the ability of electrolocation, but more on these in a bit. Whilst always known to the Aborigines, upon its settler discovery in 1798, the platypus was deemed a hoax for its crazy appearance. Researchers even used utensils to find and unpick taxidermy stitches, only to discover none existed. The name platypus is Greek in origin, meaning flat-footed, but it couldn't own this name as the genus of its binomial name due to it already belonging to the ambrosia beetle. So instead, it was named Ornithorhynchus, meaning bird snout in Greek, Ornithorhynchus anatinus, and that anatinus part of the name means duck-like in Latin. So their name, their scientific name, literally means duck-like bird snout.
Did you know, Aaron, that originally it wasn't called Ornithorhynchus anatinus; it was called Ornithorhynchus paradoxus.
I did know that. Yeah, I thought you were going to say that. The genus name might have been different because it was a little bit confusing, but I didn't write anything on the paradoxus, so please to expand.
Well, because it is a paradox, as you are suggesting, with whether this animal was real or not. And do you know where I remember that one random fact from?
I'm going to hazard a guess that it's Octonauts.
No.
Usually it's Octonauts fact that you put it up.
I mean, they're good. But this is one. This is actually the first scientific name I remember learning, other than obviously Tyrannosaurus Rex. But it came from a cartoon that came out, a cartoon film years ago that was on the TV called Dot and the Kangaroo. And it's all about a girl who ends up wandering off into the, and keep in mind, I didn't see this in Australia. I saw this in the UK.
Oh, right.
About a little girl who wanders off into the bush and ends up befriending a kangaroo who teaches her how to talk to all the animals. Right. And she basically teaches, learns all about the animals. The platypuses in that particular film do a little song about the fact that their name is Ornithorhynchus paradoxus. And that's stuck in my brain ever since. But it was one of those films that was a mixture of cartoons, and then it was put onto real film footage in the background. So you'd have the cartoon kangaroo jumping, but in the background it would be like video footage or movie footage of moving fast through like a field or something. And that was called random one there for you.
That was called Dot and the Kangaroo.
Dot and the Kangaroo.
I've never heard of it.
Probably out there somewhere. It was made by an Australian film company, but I can remember seeing it years ago, and it's stuck in my brain ever since. And then obviously it was really changed to Ornithorhynchus anatinus later on.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know that. I did know about Paradoxus. I've never heard of that program before. That's really cool. The name is quite it's quite descriptive, isn't it? Duck-like bird snout. It's very descriptive of them. But most people, upon hearing the name platypus or duck-billed platypus, will conjure word associations such as Australia and aquatic. But there's more to the platypus's habitat preferences than just these two terms. It is indeed a small watercourse-dwelling, semi-aquatic species, preferring smaller streams and rivers over the larger, faster-flowing courses. They are not so picky, however, about where these watercourses run, and they can be found from the colder temperate mountain ranges of Tasmania and the Australian Alps through to Queensland, where they frequent tropical rainforests. It can be found, as I say, along eastern and southeastern Australia, including South Australia and Kangaroo Island. Its inner mainland population, however, remains in question. I believe Kangaroo Island is actually a introduced population.
They are. They were introduced there by the South Australia Company.
Oh, right.
And I can say with some certainty they're definitely there because I swam in a river and one darted out in front of me.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Years ago. That was on work experience.
Work experience? Nice. Yeah, what did you do on the work experience then?
We were on a sheep farm, and they just said, do you want to go down to the creek and go for a bit of a swim? So we went down the creek for a bit of a swim, and a platypus jumped, jutted out in the riverbed in front of me.
How amazing.
Like that, gone, instant. Just a flash, and that's all you see.
And is that the only experience of seeing one in the wild, or have you seen more?
Technically, I've seen one semi-wild. I mean, it was a wild animal in a reserve,
right? Okay.
But it's one of the earth sanctuaries there. It was Warrawong. Oh, I can't remember what it was called now. Was it Warrawong? Yarrawong? Is it outside of Adelaide?
Right.
Okay. And it's basically set up as a predator-free protected zone, and they've got a massive lake that you could go walk around and everything. And out in the middle of it, you just see this little, all you see is a tiny little brown lump in the water, and then boom, gone.
Gone.
The moment it notices you, it's underwater.
No, that's still, though, that's fantastic, being able to see them out in the habitat and that. Oh, that's a really cool experience, Gareth. Well, to describe the platypus is to describe an animal fitting of the cryptozoological realm, not ours. They are a really odd looking animal, almost a chimera like combination of animals. Described by Colonel David Collins of the Botany Bay Colony as an amphibious animal of the mole species, this is an animal that claims the likenesses of many animals. So it's described as having a duck's beak, a beaver's tail, a mole's pelt, and an otter's body and feet. So a real mishmash. But this anatomical puzzle hides even more fascinating qualities. The duck-like beak pushes the nostrils onto the very top surface, allowing the platypus to remain mostly hidden underwater as it comes up for air. Inside the bill, young platypups have the use of three teeth, which are lost around the time of reaching independence and replaced by a keratin-based food grinding pad. The beaver-like tail stores fat reserves, and the otter-like feet are more heavily webbed on the front paws than they are on the rear paws. And those front paws also, they fold when walking on land, creating a gait and locomotion akin to knuckle dragging, like some of the apes. The legs are held outwards, like in the gait of lizards too. So really, really weird way of walking. The pelt feels like that of a mole's, like I said, but it's waterproof. And it also traps a layer of air to aid in insulating the body temperature. And if that weren't enough, the brown fur covering the body displays a degree of biofluorescence. And that is to say that under UV black light, it will give off a blue-green glow. In the head, the ear bones are incorporated into the skull, as in all mammals, but the ear opening itself is located in the lower jaw, like our synapsid ancestors. And lastly, they aren't particularly large animals, but they can reach sizes of 50 centimeters and 2.4 kilograms. But this can vary greatly depending on levels of predation and human activity in the area. So they're a really, really odd animal. Now, in describing their physical appearance, it may be relevant to cover in a bit more detail that venom and electrolocation I mentioned before. As I said, in adulthood, the platypus has no teeth. So where is this venomous spike located? Gareth, I'm pretty sure you know where it is.
I do, yes.
Where?
All right. It's on the hind leg, just behind the foot, basically.
Exactly. It's on each of the rear limbs, and it can be found on both sexes on just above the ankle. It's basically an ankle spur. Now,
pretty big ankle spur.
So you knew where it was, but did you know that only the males deliver the painful venom?
Yes. I've also heard tale of how bad the symptoms are as well.
Yeah, it's meant to be pretty painful.
Yeah.
Well, like, you know, like you're aware, I like to go into venom a little bit. So it's composed of something called defensin-like proteins, and these disrupt the nervous system. And the sting of a spur is enough to kill smaller animals, but between platypus, it's used possibly in dominance during breeding-related ruts, a theory that's supported by the fact that venom production increases during the breeding season. It's not powerful enough to kill a human, though you will be in for an extremely painful and sore experience that can last at least a couple of weeks. The pain is very long lasting, with some anecdotal accounts that I found saying well over a month in real pain. So yeah, not nice. The platypus, being a monotreme, also enjoys electrolocation, like I said, but to a much more sensitive degree than the echidna. As the animal dives, it closes the ears, the eyes, and the nostrils, and it relies solely on the electric signals pulsed out by the tiny muscles of prey species. Staying down for around 30 seconds per dive, the platypus digs into the sediment to uproot any hidden prey. The rostrochordal rows, which basically like stripes along the beak of the platypus, houses up to 40,000 electroreceptors, all of which fire in highly attuned to movements of potential prey. The platypus will turn its head back and forth, essentially scanning its habitat, and the electroreceptive rostrochordal rows will also be supported by mechanoreceptors spread evenly over the skin of the beak. Now, these utilize the platypus's sense of touch. So at the same time as sending out this electro location and receiving it back in the electroreceptors, the mechanoreceptors are making that beak super sensitive to touch. Both electroreceptors and mechanoreceptors are linked in cortical cells in the cerebral cortex of the animal's brain, meaning that they perceive the electric signals of their prey pretty much as if they are themselves being touched by the prey. That's how sensitive it is, because it's linked to the same area of the brain, and because it's working in unison in that way. And what are those prey species giving off these electro signals? Well, the platypus is typically on the hunt for invertebrates such as the yabby, larvae, shrimps, and aquatic insects. Once located and rooted out, the platypus carries them to the surface before dining. Platypus are incredible swimmers, but this ability itself manifests uniquely in platypus compared to other semi-aquatic mammals. It basically will hold the rear legs against its body, engaging them only in unison with the tail in order to aid in steering. The bulk of the swimming is actually achieved by alternating strokes of the forelimbs only. It spends about 12 hours a day hunting and requires 20% of its body weight in order to sustain itself. So even though it's only diving for 30 seconds at a time, and once it finds its prey, it comes to the surface to dispatch it, these guys are spending about half, maybe more, of their day on actually foraging for these prey species. Interestingly, despite obviously having the physiological structure to enable binocular vision of the eyes, because platypus's eyes are at the front of their face, the same as us, their eyes only contain two cones, which means the vision is not as defined as ours. And the eyes themselves are more similar to that of jawless fish of the abyssal depths than to other mammals. And as such, the eyes are not used to hunt by the platypus themselves. However, the positioning and other features of the eyes suggest that the organs were far more important to platypus ancestors than they are to the platypus of today. So their life cycle, move on to that. What does that actually look like? Because I think that's probably the bit that most of our listeners won't really be aware of. We all kind of know what a platypus is and what it looks like and where it's from. But how does it live? So basically, lying in an elaborate nesting burrow, there will be, on average, two leathery eggs, each roughly 11 millimeters in diameter. And on their 10th and final day of incubation, they are about to hatch. The puggles are born blind. By the way, I've used two different words for baby platypus, puggles and platypups, and both seem to be valid for them. But yeah, these guys are born blind, hairless, and defenseless. They've absorbed the yolk whilst incubating, and now that they've hatched, they will move on to nursing for the next 4 months from their mother's milk. The mother only leaves to forage for short periods during the first 5 weeks, and as she leaves, she'll plug the burrow at intervals with soil blockages, and these have a dual function. Firstly, obviously, plugging the burrow hides the burrow and it hides the offspring, so it protects her young. But also, as she clambers back in and removes these plugs, they actually make tighter rings in the burrow. And so this squeezes any excess water from her fur so that by the time she's back with her youngsters, she's dry. After this 5 week mark, the mother leaves for prolonged periods of time, right up until the time at which the puggles reach 4 months of age and become independent themselves. At this point, they leave the burrows to fend for themselves. They'll lose those teeth, which will be replaced with that grinding palate that we spoke about. Now, despite having plenty of predators to watch out for in the form of snakes, monitors, birds of prey, larger rodents, and introduced red foxes, adult mortality of platypus is pretty minimal, and wild specimens have been known thriving at ages of around 10 to 11 years old. Although in captivity, it's a little bit longer, as you'd expect. They've been known to reach about 17 years of age. However, its primary threat, and the threat that these youngsters, now that they're independent, are going to have to keep their eyes out for, It comes in the form of human interference. Urbanization and encroachment has largely fragmented the populations through habitat loss and the disintegration of wildlife corridors, natural wildlife corridors, that is. And urbanization is a huge problem for platypus. They're quite renowned for not being able to cope with even a minimal amount of urbanization, despite the fact that we reported, I think this year, we reported on platypus being spotted in a really urban environment. So they may be adapting slowly now. But compounding this are huge drops in water quality, not to mention interruptions to water flow caused by dam placement, nets, and irrigation measures for domestic and agricultural reasons. Climate change has increased the regularity of droughts and also wildfires within the platypus range, further affecting steady year-round habitat availability. And the Tasmanian-dwelling platypus are further hammered by a platypus-specific fungal infection caused by Mucor amphibiorum. Now, this causes lesions to form, and once open, it affects the ability of the platypus to regulate body temperature and causes a fatal risk of secondary infection. For these reasons, the IUCN has deemed it necessary to place platypus on the red list as near threatened, spurring movements to better protect the species and its range. On a similar thread to threats and conservation, we should note its significance to our species, its significance to us, humans. Both settlers and Aborigines hunted the platypus, the settlers for pelt and prestige, the Aborigines for food. However, they are particularly significant to the Aborigines through their Dreamtime stories. Stories from Darling River tell of an animal whose allegiance was fought over by the land animals, the water animals, and the birds. Ultimately, the platypus felt he didn't need to join a team to be special and declined all offers, choosing instead, in a very kind of Switzerland kind of move, to remain friends to everybody. And I think that's a nice kind of note to end off on with platypus. They are a fantastic little animal, not just weird looking, but extremely beautiful in their oddness, I think. And they're a wonderful animal, and one of those animals as well that the native people living in these areas knew about well before the European settlers. And then when the European settlers come, they couldn't possibly open their minds to the idea that this animal could exist. And then one by one, the explorers among the settlers start to find them, and they were written off as mad or as lying, making hoaxes. It's a story that it shares with the okapi in Africa, the little cousin of the giraffe. It too was thought to be a cryptozoological hoax until they found it. So really, really cool animal to look into.
Well, I mean, I'm going to, you know, this is something that I bet this is never a thing that people say. I'm going to defend the white European settler here, being one myself. To be completely fair, Australia in itself is an odd enough place.
It's a very
and
odd place.
To come from Europe and to go there at an age where, you know, the voyage itself would have taken a good couple of months, you know, to have got there by ship. It is akin to being an alien world, and the creatures in it completely bizarre, you know, things that would not have been seen by people, environments that were not seen by people. For the longest time, there was the assumption that there was a giant inland sea in the middle of Australia that had to be there. And all of these Victorian and earlier than that explorers setting off to basically die in the desert to prove that there was an inland sea there that just, well, was not.
It was a desert.
basically, but I mean, granted, the stupidity of humans in that we insist on doing things in a way that suits us. So you ended up with people going off into these places dressed in woolen hats and, you know, all sorts of totally inappropriate gear. But yeah, I mean, to have found a platypus originally must have been utterly bizarre and just mind-blowing, I suppose.
I think, just to prove your point and back you up a little bit there, I think we take for granted just how weird kangaroos are. Because we see them so often in zoos. Now, platypus, we still don't see in zoos, so they still have that mystique, that oddness about them. But kangaroos and wallabies and wallaroos, we see that body plan in zoos so often, and we see them on TV so often that we forget just how weird that animal is. There's nothing like a kangaroo anywhere else in the world.
Just remember as well, Aaron, that when Europeans turned up in North America with horses, the Native Americans had no idea what these creatures were. They'd never seen horses, even though horses originated in North America, evolved there and then crossed over into Eurasia and then went extinct in the Americas. They never saw an animal that was remotely like that. So yeah, it doesn't take much, I suppose. There's a bunch of animals out there that even some of our listeners who are avid animal natural history people will have never heard of or find utterly bizarre that they exist.
There's bound to be species that will surprise us all. If you're not Spanish or from the Americas, you might not. Maybe if you're Spanish or American, you might not know, but you're more likely to know than others. That the horse actually was introduced by the Spaniards. The Mustang was introduced by the Spanish. But I mentioned the okapi just now, and there's another similarity that it bears with the platypus, which makes it a good candidate for an animal that could be seen as cryptozoological and considered a hoax until it was more widely discovered. And that's the fact that it too is a bit of a chimera. You've got the platypus, which has, you've got beaver, otter, mole, and duck kind of features. But the okapi, it looks like a miniature giraffe with a deer-coloured coat, except for the back end. The back end is strikingly similar to a zebra. So again, it's one of those weird animals that crosses the streams of different animals and makes for a really odd-looking creature. So yeah, just another chimera form that throws what you know out the window.
Yeah, very cool. Should we head into the mystery that is our mailbag for this week then?
Let's do it.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email.
Right, well, we're into this week's emails, and we're going to kick things off with last week's question, which was, what is your favorite North American dinosaur? Plain and simple. Although I thought we'd get more answers to this one, to be honest, because I thought this would be a nice, easy one for people to just throw their favorite dinosaur out there, and it would almost certainly be North American. But going down the list, Stuart Beard has said it has to be the T-Rex, just so iconic. I mean, it's probably the most American of American dinosaurs. Louisa O'Leary has put me. I'm assuming she's referring to herself, but that's not fair. That's not very good on yourself there. Don't be so down on yourself. Jen Babs has put Triceratops. We've got the two probably single most iconic American dinosaurs there. We've also got another vote for Triceratops from Karen Kuhn Wright. And then Pete Watts has put Donald Trump. Well, that's insulting to dinosaurs, I'm afraid. very insulting to dinosaurs. I'm not sure what Donald Trump is, but he's not a dinosaur. He's something. Definitely something.
Not something that we can repeat on this because we're trying to be
family friendly. I don't think I want to even give it the airtime. That was last week's question. But based on this week's creature feature, which is the fantastic platypus, an animal so bizarre that people tried to unstitch stitching that wasn't there, this week's question is going to be, what animal were you amazed existed? Basically, is there an animal that has been so weird that you had no idea it could have even existed. And then someone showed you and you're like, oh, okay, that's real. We'll go with that. So, Aaron, is there an animal that you feel that you were shocked to find out existed? Maybe shocked, not shocked, but, you know.
Because I interpreted the question slightly differently, because my answer will now have to be different to what it would have been.
Well, you tell me either way what your...
What my answer was going to be, what surprises, impresses, or me the most, my answer was going to be, as much as people aren't going to like this answer, is actually humans. Because we have everything, I suppose humans and elephants, maybe, because of how, like, we are literally the universe evolving its own conscious and then debating its own existence, which is really strange and really weird and really existential. Okay, so to reinterpret your question, shock, that I don't know if any animal shocks me exactly.
Well, maybe not shocked, but exists, one that you were amazed when you found out that it existed.
Well, certainly platypus would have been there. I think blue whale is, but I'll tell you what would be my top answer. It would be octopus. Not necessarily any specific species, but for example, the common octopus, which with a name like that, you think that's going to be quite, you know, very vanilla octopus. But no, the common octopus is one of the octopus species it's a general octopus trait, really. So I should reword that. But they can't just change color to camouflage in their environment, like a stealth thing, like, I don't know, Metal Gear Solid or The Predator. These guys, their skin will change color, but also change texture to match with. So it will go like sandpapery, or it will go craggy like rock, or it will go leafy like coral. You know, it will change its color, but it'll also change the texture and the shape of the skin to hide itself perfectly. I think that is just an absolutely mind-blowing trait. And if you delve into the that kind of group of animals, your octopus, your squid, your cuttlefish, and so on and so forth, they're all really fascinating when it comes to that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's pretty good. There's two that stick in my mind, and it was from like being a kid, obviously. I suppose the older you get and the more you sort of spend time looking at these things, the less and less bizarre things just pop out, and it's more the facts, like you're saying, Aaron, that become what are the amazing aspects of the animal, not the animal itself becoming the, you know, the bizarre thing. There's two that feature in my mind from learning about as a child and being somewhat obsessed with them for a brief period. Pelugos, which is the flying lemur, which is an odd looking animal at the best of times. They're gorgeous. Annoyingly, you quite often see them being paraded around in these like TikTok videos or whatever from someone in Indonesia will have found one and making it out like it's some sort of bizarre human hybrid thing, when it is basically they sit on their own weird little branch of the the family of mammals. They're often referred to as a flying lemur. They're not a lemur, and they can't fly. But superficially, their face does look a bit like a lemur. They're more closely related to primates than to a lot of other things, but they're on their own little branch. So they're quite an oddity, and I was quite amazed by them as a child that they existed. The other thing is hammerhead worms, which are a real... I mean, the world of worms... Not just your bog standard earthworm, there are so many bizarre flatworms and things like that out there. But hammerhead worms are just odd. They are bizarre. Yeah. And some of the tropical species of them have these hammerhead shapes. And they basically predate along the ground looking for earthworms, for slugs and snails. And they then secrete digestive enzymes on them and basically dissolve them there on their skin as they hunt them. It's a pretty gruesome way of hunting things down, but they're just bizarre. And some of them, you can literally cut them in two and you will end up with two flat worms. They reproduce through what's known as binary fission where they separate into two completely separate entities, you know, so they don't need to reproduce in the same way that other animals do. So, yeah, weird really animal, bizarre yeah. creatures. And unfortunately, there is a very large amount of introduced species right here in the UK. In fact, the other day when I was out in the garden turning over some slates that I was moving from one part of the garden to the other, I came across the Australian flatworm in the garden, basically, and had to get rid of it because they are invasive and they are detrimental to our earthworms. But yeah, unmistakable.
You made me think about a few more actually animals that, because you mentioned animals that blew your mind when you were a kid. I think when I was a kid, I certainly think that Tyrannosaurus Rex, Stegosaurus, and Triceratops would have blown my mind at the time. Maybe even something like Brachiosaurus. But also, when you said hammerhead flatworm, I know it's a different animal, but hammerhead shark.
Yeah.
That is such an insane, like, why? Why?
Yeah.
And then, but then you work out what actually, why it's shaped like that and how that, we need to do a creature feature on hammerhead shark because they're incredible.
Well, next Shark Week, I think they should be thrown into the mix. We've not done hammerheads. So we've done many other species of shark, but yeah, not hammerheads. Well, there you go, dear listener. If you have got an animal that amazed you the first time you heard about it, let us know. Let us know on our Facebook page where that will be going up. And you can put your comment, join the others in the comments to let us know. And we'll read that out next week. You can also get in contact with us on our Twitter, our Facebook page, and our Instagram, where we've got different bits and pieces going up every week with different random facts. And you can join in the discussion, things like that. We've also got our fantastic Patreon, which, Aaron, you're going to tell us all about our lovely Patreons.
Yes, I am. Again, I'm going to wimp out of doing any voices because I'm still fighting off not feeling particularly well. But we would nonetheless love to this opportunity to thank Chelsea McKee, Connie P., Jen Greenhall, and Fogtober. As always, guys, your continued support on a Patreon level, it just goes above and beyond, and it's really going to help us shape this podcast in the future.
Yeah, yeah. We are in the middle of making and doing some things behind the scenes that will be coming out within the next week or weeks or so that should have only eventuated themselves because of you guys. But money isn't everything, and you can support us in a variety of different ways. The first one is obviously, well, listening to us. If you've got this far into the episode, congratulations. You're at this point of the episode, and thank you for being here. You can also like, subscribe, or comment on whatever podcasting service you are listening to us on. Telling people about us as well is a fantastic way of getting the word out there. Podcasts live and die on the word of mouth, and you just telling someone about a bizarre bunch of people talking about bizarre animals can make a new listener out of them, convert them all to us. You can also join in on all of our conversations on social media as well, like and share and subscribe and all that good stuff that goes on there. You can find us on our lovely T-Mill store as well, where Drew has been working hard on lots of different T-shirt combinations. And there's some, I believe, some new ones coming soon on there, I think.
I think so.
Platypus would be a good one to go on there, I think. That'd look quite nice. Mm. But as well, if you are wanting to come and see us in person, live, not hidden behind the wonders of whatever you're listening to us on, you can come.
Not
on
in
to...
a cupboard.
Well, yeah.
Not in a cupboard.
Actually, yeah. Well, they might put us in a cupboard. You never know. You know, they might bring
maybe
in
they
a,
should.
They might bring in a wardrobe or something just to put us in it whilst we're in this room talking to people. We are going to be at Barnstable Library on April the 13th doing a live talk about the River Tor, which we've been getting all bits and pieces sorted around in the background to do that. So yeah, feel free to try and book tickets for that if you are interested. Apart from that, that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode. So Aaron, a big thank you for coming along and your voice surviving as long as mine has as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me, especially today of all days, because I don't know if I've told you this, Gareth, but it would have been my dad's 68th birthday today.
Aww.
So we're recording it on his birthday. It's been a bit of, it's one of those days where there's a lot of sadness, but you kind of think back on good things. And my dad was always very, I've been very lucky because my dad and my mum, I wouldn't be doing this podcast if it wasn't for my mum's continued support and the memory of my dad's support, because they were both pivotal, and my mum still is pivotal in my kind of fascination for the natural world and for animals and stuff. So yeah, on this occasion, I'm just very grateful to my dad, and so it was nice to do it today.
Yeah, I mean, your mum is also always one of those people who shares out what we're doing quite often.
Yeah, that's true.
Facebook and social media. So a big thank you to her and to your dad for shaping you as the person that you are today. Yeah, and a big thank you to you at home for listening. And we will see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye. One does not simply call themselves an animal in Australia without having a duck's bill, a mole's coat, an otter's body, a beaver's tail. You can cut me off whenever you like.